Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Michael Pembroke makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. It comes around the time of the paperback version of Arthur Phillip Saylor, The Mercenary Governor's Spy, which was a most successful book that came out, I think, in 2013. Okay. And I'll introduce our speaker briefly because he's well known to you. He's a writer, a naturalist, a historian, and a judge, currently a judge of the Supreme Court of New South Wales. But Michael Pembroke today is speaking in his capacity as a writer, naturalist, historian, and his topic for tonight is Australia's strategic origins in the South Pacific and its future in East Asia. Michael, you're welcome. Thank you.
What I'd like to do, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming tonight, I see some familiar faces, is speak to you about the geopolitics of the 18th century, which was the context in which the first settlement in Australia was established. And then I'd like to move to the geopolitics of Northeast Asia, because that's the subject of my current book project. And it's actually, as Gerard said, 3 years since I wrote Philip, but 4 years and a little bit more since I wrote, 3 years since the book was published and 4 years since I wrote the book. So although I spoke a lot about it in the first couple of years after publication, my memory dimmed, and it took some time to bring it all back for the purposes of this talk, because I've been somewhat consumed since early last year with the next project. But let me give you a few dates, and we'll work our way through those formative years relevant to the establishment of the first colony in New South Wales. 1770, you all know, James Cook claimed the east coast of Australia, and he was very fuzzy about how far west his claim extended. It was basically to the Great Dividing Range, as far as the eye could see from his ship. There was no specification of the western boundary. 2 years later, in 1772, the first French government expedition in search of the Great Southland landed in Western Australia. It was commanded by a man called Kerguelen, after whom some islands are named in the southern Indian Ocean, and his deputy was a man called St. Alouan. They landed on the west coast near Dirk Hartog Island. And I'll just read something to you from the book because it may sound familiar. The annexation ceremony took place on the cliffs above Turtle Bay on Dirk Hartog Island. Just as Cook had done, the French wandered inland and did not recognise any evidence of organised human occupation. They then raised the flag, read a formal proclamation claiming possession in the name of Louis XV, shouted Vive le Roi 3 times and fired 3 volleys of musket shot. Before leaving, they buried one of their seamen in the sand and left several bottles, a few French coins, and a white ensign. So, within the space of 2 years, there were competing claims to the east coast and the west coast of Australia. The international law of nations at the time provided that in order to take control of an uninhabited country, you had to do more than make a claim. You had to consummate the claim by settling, civilising, cultivating and establishing a settlement. Hence, there was a great urgency in France and in Britain over the next 20 years to ensure that what were what lawyers call inchoate claims or incomplete claims were completed. Now let's move forward to 1778. In 1778, Philip was in Rio de Janeiro. It was the last few months of his 4 years of service as a captain in the Portuguese Navy. This was a period of his life where he excelled himself. In fact, there were several periods like this, but this period gave him a great step up. He served with great distinction and was very well regarded by the Portuguese governor, Lavradio, who sent very praiseworthy testimonials back to London. The reason why Philip was in the Portuguese Navy was to assist it, and Portugal and Britain were old allies, to assist it in a war that was then taking place with Spain in South America. Portugal owned Brazil, Spain owned most of the rest of South America. They were warring over territory around the River Plate estuary, where Montevideo was on one side and Buenos Aires is on the other. And in fact, the war indirectly and eventually gave rise to the country we now know as Uruguay. When a peace treaty was reached, it was called the Treaty of Santo Ildefonso. The peace treaty stated and recognised that the ancient line of separation, the papal line through the Atlantic Ocean, which divided the old world between Spain and Portugal, was still continued. Not only did it still continue, but that it continued, and this was the new part, into the eastern hemisphere of the globe. Now, no one in Whitehall knew as much about the current political dynamics of the ancient line of separation between Portugal and Spain as much as Philip. It actually became terribly significant to the claim which, or to the territory over which Philip was given control when he was commissioned by His Majesty's government in 1786. Let me just explain. Philip sat down in Whitehall for weeks and months on end in the autumn of 1786 and the winter and the following winter through to May 87 when he left. The terms of his commission were matters on which he was vitally interested and he had a lot of input into them. He proposed, and the government accepted, that the western boundary of New South Wales should be the 135th meridian of longitude. By adopting that boundary, the British government was seeking to respect the ancient line of separation and avoid offending the Dutch. I say the Dutch because the Dutch was effectively the legatee of Portugal in the Indian Ocean. The prospect of offending Spain did not seem to matter. Spain was an inveterate enemy. Holland was involved in negotiations at the time with France, and it was very delicate. That this was the true reason for selecting this western border emerges from a preface which Sir Joseph Banks wrote to Matthew Flinders' famous book called A Voyage to Terra Australis. Sir Joseph Banks explained that the selection of the 135th meridian was intended to observe the ancient line of separation with which it was nearly corresponding. But that's what he wrote in the draft. The issue was apparently so sensitive that Sir Robert Peel, who was the Under Secretary for Colonies, requested Banks to omit any notice, I'm quoting here, of the reasons which are supposed to have informed His Majesty's government in placing the western boundary of New South Wales. Banks got in a huff about this, withdrew his preface, and it was never published, except that it still exists and historians know about it. But that's how we came, that's how New South Wales came to extend basically from what Cook could see from the coast to the 135th meridian, which is way over near the current border of Western Australia, but not the same. Well, we then have to move forward to 1784. 1784, Philip is sent to France. He's returned from the his time in the American Revolutionary Wars. He's returned from a huge expedition which covered much of the ground that he would later cover with the First Fleet. And he was much favoured in Whitehall, especially by Nepean, who was the Undersecretary of the Home Office. And the Home Office was responsible for colonies and espionage. Philip was sent as an espionage agent to France because there was a great concern about the French Navy rebuilding itself. Ever since the Seven Years' War, which was 56 to 63, when France suffered terrible losses, it had been on a mission to rebuild its navy. And this, of course, was a concern to the British. So Philip was sent to the ports of Toulon and the other ports of France. We have two of his reports that he sent back, but we know that there were five because they're numbered in a series, and the two reports are two of those five reports. While he was there, he must have come across La Perouse. The great expedition of La Perouse was being fitted out in Brest Harbour in 1785. This brings me forward to 1786. This is the year that the decision was made to establish the colony. It was a decision made in a time of great urgency and great anxiety, and it was made on a Saturday morning, which was unusual for cabinet meetings. There were two, even then, there were two motivating factors in the geopolitical sense. There was the concern about the overflowing of hulks, but that it wouldn't have happened without these other issues. The first was the concern about the French colonisation of, or the possible French colonisation of New South Wales or New Zealand. So let me read a few passages. This time Louis XVI is the king. He was the grandson of Louis XV. The monarchy skipped a generation. His father died of tuberculosis. And he was a young and very much a figure of the Enlightenment. Most people think of La Perouse's expedition as scientific and geographic, but Louis's instructions required La Perouse to consider and report upon the possibilities of commerce and the suitability for settlement of the lands visited by him. And he was specifically requested to ascertain whether the English had formed a settlement on the islands of New Zealand. Well, the French curiosity about whether the English had actually settled any of the newly discovered lands in the South Pacific was matched by an equivalent British concern that the French might do so themselves before they did. So you have the British ambassador in Paris, Dorset, expressing great anxiety in May 1785, passing on that he heard that La Perouse had orders to visit New Zealand and that the French have a design of establishing some kind of settlement there. And the following month, both he and Dalrymple, who was another diplomat and also, I think, a cousin of Dorset, each of them passed on intelligence, which ultimately proved to be wrong, but this is what they believed at the time, that there was little room to doubt that the French had a desire to make a settlement in New Zealand by landing convicts there. In particular, the intelligence included the alarming information that 60 criminals from the prison at Bicêtre, which is in the southeast of Paris, were last Monday conveyed under strong guard and with great secrecy to Brest, where they are to be embarked on board Monsieur de La Pérouse's ships, and it is imagined that they are to be left to take possession of the lately discovered country. So that was one anxiety. The other anxiety became manifest the next year, in 1786. In 1786, the lead up to the decision by Pitt, Sidney, Nepean, who were the core of the cabinet. Nepean wasn't in the cabinet, but he was a most influential civil servant, who made the decision to establish the colony, was this. In February of 1786, the ambassador, the British ambassador at The Hague, who some historians say was the foremost ambassador of the age, a man called Harris, warned that the intentions of France in forming a connection with the Dutch Republic are too evident to admit of doubt. Of course, the Dutch and the French both had possessions in India. Then the French engaged in transparently provocative actions in the Bay of Bengal around the entrance to the Ganges River, a bit like ships manoeuvring in the South China Sea. These were the first drumbeats of war, and then they were followed by a series of alarming news items in quick succession. On the 1st of August, Harris wrote that there would soon be a major development and that France intended to send troops to the Dutch bases in India. On the 8th of August, a week later, he reported that the crisis is drawing nearer and nearer every hour. And on the 16th of August, Sidney, who was the Home Secretary, and that was a terribly important position, and had a lot more to do with home affairs than the name suggests, sent an account to the King of the French naval capacity in the east being India. The King was George III, and like Louis XVI, he was the grandson of the previous monarch. Both of them lost their fathers, and the monarchy skipped a generation. In fact, it's a great interest of mine, and I might make it a project one day. Frederick, who was the father of George III, is supposed to have died after being hit by a cricket ball in a cricket match. And he was a great gambler and a great cricketer. Gambling with cricket, that is. Anyway, so the King was informed about the French naval capacity in the East, and within hours, George III acknowledged what Pitt and Sidney and their colleagues had been warning him, and that the French have a considerable capacity to collect a major force in the East Indies. 3 days later, on a Saturday morning, Pitt's cabinet decided to establish a settlement in New South Wales. And then I'll finish this sequence of events with La Pérouse again. I'll come back to him. Because, as I think most of you know, the 11 ships of the First Fleet arrived in Botany Bay between the 18th and 20th of January 1788. 4 days later, on the 24th of January, two large French ships, La Boussole and L'Astrolabe, arrived off the entrance to Botany Bay. They were La Pérouse's ships. Philip didn't want to have anything to do with La Pérouse. He wouldn't meet him. The Melbourne historian, Alan Frost, suggests that he was concerned that La Pérouse might recognise him from his days undercover in France. And also, more probably, or just as probably, Philip did not want La Pérouse to see the advantages of Port Jackson, which hadn't been charted and the French hadn't seen. And Cook hadn't seen either. No one saw it. The first person to see it was Philip and his men. So that's what happened. It was no accident that La Pérouse arrived there on that date. He'd been sent a message from France. This is a lovely story. When the French learned about Philip's expedition, the Minister for Marine said, "We must get a message to La Pérouse." They worked out that at a certain time he would be in Kamchatka, north of Japan, north of Korea, in the far northeast, near Sakhalin. And how do you get a message across to someone in that position in those days? And they had to send dispatch riders. And can you imagine relays of horses from Paris to St. Petersburg, Moscow, all the way across the tundra to Petropavlovsk and then Kamchatka? Anyway, they got a message to La Perouse just before he was due to depart, and said, the message effectively said, go straight down to Botany Bay and check out what the English are doing. And so he arrived 3 days, 4 days after the last ship. Now, I want to move to another part of the world, at least a part of the world that affects Australia. And you may not know, but there were 3 supply ships in the First Fleet, 6 transport ships, 3 supply ships and 2 naval ships. The 3 supply ships, after they'd unloaded and completed their responsibilities, headed to China, up round Cape York, through the Sunda Strait, up into the South China Sea. They were chartered from the East India Company. They were going to collect tea and bring the tea back to London. That's where I want to go now, because understanding the historical origins of the instability in Northeast Asia is something that we all owe it to ourselves to do, because only when you know the history can you understand or can you make the right decisions. The Chinese, I must say, and you probably know this, have a great feel for their own history. And I'll point that out in a moment in relation to one particular matter that's happening. Let me read from the book. I won't say the book. I shouldn't say the book. I'll read from my manuscript. What the editors do to it, I cannot promise. The fateful proposal that the Korean nation should be partitioned at the 38th parallel was an American initiative made by a little-known wartime policy committee known as the State War Navy Coordinating Committee. It was called SWNC after its acronym SWNCC. The proposed dividing line was selected on the 10th of August 1945 around midnight in room number 866 in the Pentagon by 2 young colonels in the State Department. They were working from the March 1944 issue of the National Geographic magazine, which contained a map of the Korean Peninsula. One of the colonels was Dean Rusk, who later became a Secretary of State. You might ask, why did they do this? Well, it was the 10th of August. Hiroshima occurred on the 6th, Nagasaki on the 9th of August. But more importantly, and some say this was the crucial factor in Japan's surrender, was this. Russia intervened in the Pacific War. Stalin had agreed at Yalta was February 45, to enter the war against Japan within 3 months of the end of the war in Europe. The German surrender took place on the 8th of May, and precisely 3 months later, on the evening of the 8th of August, 2 days after Hiroshima, Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov informed the Japanese ambassador of his government's hostile intentions. At 1 minute past midnight, on the 9th of August, the Soviet army moved into Manchuria. It's the area north of the Korean border. On a grand scale, its front, consisting of 3 army groups, and I see some ex-army people here, a group is a large number, 1.5 million men and over 5,000 tanks, extended more than 4,600 kilometres from the Pacific coast to eastern Inner Mongolia. Its manifest ability to occupy the whole of the peninsula, that is the Korean Peninsula, before American forces could arrive was a source of consternation in the Pentagon. By 10 August, the first elements of the Russian 25th Army had entered northeast Korea. A fortnight later, they'd completed occupation as far south as Pyongyang. By 1 September, they had effected occupation to the 38th parallel. So impressed was one American military historian that he named the Soviet invasion of Manchuria and the Korean Peninsula Operation August Storm. I can see some blank faces. He was picking up on Operation Desert Storm. which was Iraq. The first Gulf War, 1991. Now, the partition was a unilateral initiative. The United Kingdom was not consulted, nor was any other allied power. Korea was ignored. Stalin acquiesced, intriguingly and without demur. Well, that's how it all started. What followed for 3 years was the occupation of the North and the South by occupying armies of Soviet Russia and the United States. The State Department professed to have as its objective the unification of the country under a trusteeship, an international trusteeship. The Pentagon had different ideas, and certainly the occupation army commander, General Hodge, and his Soviet counterpart had different ideas. So the two occupation armies built client states. And by 1948, there was no turning back. In 1948, two states emerged. The South Korean state called itself the Republic of Korea, and it came into existence in August after an election which was supervised by the United Nations, but which was terribly controversial. The North Korean state came into existence a couple of weeks later after an election, but one which was not supervised by the United Nations. But as a British court made clear some decades ago in the 1970s, whether a nation state comes into existence or not depends upon the practicalities of control and jurisdiction, and not whether the United Nations supervises their election or not. So we had two states, and for 2 years they were sparring. It was never clear who would invade the other first, because the president of South Korea was always saying that he wanted to unify the peninsula, and the president of North Korea was making the same statements. Both presidents had been brought in by their respective occupation armies from outside. Kim Il-sung, Kim number one, was brought in from Manchuria. He was actually originally born in North Korea, but he'd gone off to Manchuria to fight the Japanese. And the South Korean president, a man called Syngman Rhee, was brought in from the United States, where he'd spent most of his life. Now, so the war happened. The war started in June 1950. Before dawn on a Sunday morning, the North Korean army invaded. They had 120 Soviet tanks. Stalin had provided the material that Kim Il-sung needed. It should have been straightforward. Kim Il-sung thought it would be straightforward, a matter of weeks, but President Truman was not going to have a bar of it, and sent across the occupation army in Japan. They had a hard time because they were soft. They'd been living a good life in Japan. They all had houseboys. My father used to say they were overfed and undertrained. And it was the first 3 months were very tough, but they turned it around, and after 3 months, they had re-established the border. The United Nations resolution, which authorised the intervention, authorised the a United Nations force to restore the border and, repel the invasion and restore the security of the border. Repel and restore. So it was all over in 3 months by the end of September. At that point, a decision was made that many historians have said was tragic. Washington decided, and there was a fair amount of hubris involved here because they'd been so successful in pushing back the North Koreans. Washington decided to cross the border itself. So it complained about the North Koreans crossing the border. It now crossed the border itself and moved towards the Yalu River, approaching China. China had nothing to do with the war at this stage, nothing at all. It wasn't there. But China was very concerned that the American-led forces, and I say American-led because they were 95% of the UN forces, were going to threaten their border. Chou Enlai made a memorable statement in which he said, China cannot stand idly by and watch the Americans approach its border. I want to particularly mention that because just a few weeks ago I read that a Chinese official said in the context of the South China Sea, China cannot stand idly by. And I said earlier that the Chinese know their history. They all know what happened, and they know the history repeats itself. So the Chinese were, I'll only be another few minutes, the Chinese were waiting for the Americans. They crossed the Yalu River at night and went into the mountains. And to adopt a phrase that Mao used, they lured the enemy in deep. So the American-led forces moved further and further into the mountains, closer to the border. The Chinese waited. They had brought in, without any of them being noticed, over 200,000 troops. It was the most successful mass infiltration in modern history. I'm quoting someone else. Regrettably, and it's not as well known as it should be, when they decided to attack, it was an unmitigated disaster. Let me just read something to you. China reacted by entering the conflict in force with great bravery and using exceptional infantry tactics. The resulting retreat, the Americans turned around and fled, I'm afraid to say. Max Hastings is extremely critical. Caustic, actually. The resulting retreat by the United States 8th Army was not merely the longest in American military history, the longest. It was, and I'm quoting here, the most disgraceful, the most infamous, and one of the worst military disasters in history. In reality, it was a rout, and President Truman declared a state of emergency. The official historian of the Korean War, the official Australian historian, said that legitimate questions about the wisdom, morality, and legality of taking offensive action north of the 38th parallel were ignored. In fact, they were lost beneath a wave, which some of you may recognise, of moral righteousness and misplaced confidence. Doubters were sidelined, sceptics labelled as appeasers, and allies were either, and remember this phrase, with us or against us. In a pattern that has become familiar since, the quest for UN authority to cross the 38th parallel was mired in unconvincing rationalisation, transparent ambiguity, and diplomatic and legal machinations reminiscent of the wrangling over the justification for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, which is rather timely given the recent Chilcot report. Well, that's not the end of it, of course. The army was pushed back, and then they recovered, and they turned around, and the fighting stabilised along the 38th parallel, where it had started. And it continued there for over 2 years and finished there. So the war started at the 38th parallel. It ended at the 38th parallel. And the number of lives lost is, according to most estimates, 3 to 4 million people. Most of whom, the vast majority of whom, lost their lives after the initial resolution of the United Nations had been successfully achieved. That is, the invasion pushback. Now, some of that is, all of that, I suppose, is political, and not everyone will agree with it or even like it, but that's where I'm going with the next project. And I should say that if you're wondering why, it arises, or it has arisen out of my father's story. He was there He was a young lieutenant. He fought in the battle called Marian Sang, which is well known to military historians. As a young lieutenant, he was in charge of a platoon, 20 or 30 men, all older than him. He was a 22-year-old stripling. He saw a lot, especially at Marian Sang. So that story was the incentive for me to write the complete picture, which is along the way. Not there yet. Anyway, I've taken up my half hour, and I'm happy to answer questions. If anyone wants to ask me what it's like inside North Korea, I can tell you, because my wife and I were there in April and May.
Many thanks. Do you want a drink of water or anything?
No, I'm fine.
You're fine. Many thanks to Michael Pembroke. Now, Janet Grundy, we've moved from Captain Phillip in 1788 and all that to the Korean War. So it's been an exciting journey. But just to go back to where we started from, Janet Grundy's got copies of the paperback edition, which followed the hardback edition of Arthur Philip Sala, Mercenary Governor or Spy, which was a very well-reviewed book when it came out a few years ago, and I'm sure Michael Pembroke would be happy to sign any copies. And so we come to questions and discussion. Can I just lead off where you ended up? Maybe I missed it, but at one stage, hundreds of thousands of Chinese and North Korean forces invaded South Korea, and Seoul fell, I think, on three occasions, and ended up down the southeast corner of Pusan, which was what was left of the anti-communist forces, who then drove back from there. So if China was all that concerned about the defence of its own borders, which had shared a border with North Korea, what's the explanation for the massive Chinese-North Korean invasion supported, I think, by Soviet air power over the 38th parallel with the intention of conquering the entire area of South Korea, which had been, as you point out, which had been created with the agreement of the United Nations across the 38th parallel?
The Chinese did not go down to the bottom of the Korean Peninsula. They only entered the war tentatively on the 25th of October as a feeler, and then at the end of November. They came in when the Americans were approaching and close to the Yalu River. The only enemy forces that got down to Pusan and the south of Korea were the North Koreans in the initial three-month incursion. The North Koreans were the ones, without any Chinese assistance, because they were at home in China, who bottled up for some time the Americans around Pusan in the southeast. When the Chinese eventually came in, approximately 4 months after the war had started, the American retreat was so extensive that the Chinese kept coming south, and they pushed the Americans beyond the 38th parallel, but not too far, maybe 100 kilometres at the most. And then the Americans turned around and pushed them back. So there was a short period of time when the Chinese were in South Korea, but only a short time. The fighting stabilised on the 38th parallel at the end of March 1951, and there it stayed from March 51 to July 53. It was like trench warfare in the First World War. Both sides, especially the Chinese and North Koreans, built tunnels and deep trenches, and they watched each other the whole time, sent out patrols, and in fact, my father says, he's still alive, that they were watching each other all the time, from one hill to another, and they developed a certain familiarity, even a certain respect, and they even got to the point in winter when it was freezing and there was snow everywhere, where when one of them wanted to go out and use the latrines, they'd hold up a toilet roll so the Chinese on the other hill could see it and not shoot them.
But the 100 kilometres beyond the 38th parallel captures the capital of Seoul.
Yes, you're just below Seoul.
So, well, the Chinese have captured the capital of South Korea.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it didn't last long. But
because they got driven out.
Yeah.
Can I say an irony of history?
Yes.
Today, China would probably be much more relaxed about South Korea having conquered the North than having kept the North in the communist hands. Because if I were a Chinese, the Chinese government, I'd be much more relaxed about South Korea not likely to lob any nuclear weapons on, or nuclear bombs on my side than I would be on the North. But I would say that right now the Chinese would have probably regretted that they didn't. They didn't let the South invade the North.
Okay. Yes. China, well, South Korea doesn't have any nuclear weapons, but it has.
The North.
Yes. China is very concerned by South Korea at the moment, very concerned, and by Japan. And the situation is far more unstable now than it was in the 1990s.
Yes, but they're much more worried about the North Koreans invading and just walking out of North Korea. Okay.
And President Xi is a bit fed up with Kim Jong-un, Kim number 3, because he's a bit of a wild card.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Right, where there is a question down here. Yeah.
ASAM's to Bougainville built the La Perouse monuments in La Perouse. Where does he fit in your story?
So the man who built the La Perouse monument at La Perouse, whose name is?
Bougainville.
Where does he fit into your story?
Well, he doesn't fit because my book is about the life of Arthur Phillip, and that's the life of a British naval officer who happened to spend 5 years in New South Wales. So the only time in the book when I concentrate on New South Wales is the time when Phillip was here. So I haven't talked about it tonight, but much of the book is about his time in other parts of the world and in England, about his personal life and his professional life elsewhere. Yes.
Yes, Chris, down there, yeah.
I think it would have been nice to mention the fact that your father received the military cross, if you remember saying.
Yes.
Which, of course, most known is just run below the Victoria Cross.
Yes.
Okay, yes. So the suggestion is that perhaps you were being too modest. You should have mentioned your father won a military cross in Korea.
Yes, well, you know, in December 1950, he graduated at Duntroon with the Sword of Honour, and 8 months later he was on the battlefield and won the Military Cross. But that's what happened in those days. And as you know, the soldiers, most of whom were World War II veterans, that is, the enlisted soldiers, were very tough, experienced men. And these young lieutenants were very wet behind the ears.
Oh, your father's Arthur Pembroke?
Yes.
He put in the telephone system in this office. He was helping out when we came in here. He was doing a bit of voluntary work for us, and we much appreciate it. And he put in the phone system, and when we had to replace it, the Telstra guy said, "This is one of the best phone systems I've ever seen installed in an old property."
I know nothing about that, but it must be at least 25 years ago.
It is. It was 1989.
Right.
And I said to the Telstra guy, "Well, we only get MCs to put in the telephone system. Who else would you trust?" No. Question down the back.
When the American
Convention
came with the parallel, do you think they would have gone into China?
No.
When the Americans ventured beyond the 38th parallel, do you think they would have gone into China?
No. They had no intention of crossing the Yalu River, but the Chinese apprehended that they might.
Question here?
Whereabouts in the developments of the Korean War that you've narrated did MacArthur's expedition behind the Korean lines into a point north of the then frontier or fighting boundary occur? Because at that point the American forces were under some pressure, I understood, and that had he not taken that step, they were in fairly serious risk of actually being effectively expelled.
Okay, the question about General MacArthur's expedition beyond the North Korean line.
The United Nations Command Force was controlled and directed by the American military. So General MacArthur was the first commander of the United Nations force. There were two others after him. In the three-month period during which the North Korean invasion moved south and before it was rebuffed, MacArthur masterminded the rebuffing by a rather dangerous and ambitious but highly successful invasion at Incheon behind the North Korean lines. So 70,000 Marines were landed at Incheon Harbour, caught the North Koreans by surprise, and very quickly moved through and took Seoul. And at that stage, the North Korean army became a rabble, and that's why I said that at the end of September 1950, 3 months after the war started, the border had been restored.
Jim, and then Lindsay.
Yes, Jim?
Michael, tell us about your... you weren't just there as tourists in North Korea. You're bursting to tell us, and I'm sure we're all interested.
No.
Was it as bad as what's been written about conditions?
You won't see it.
North Korea?
We were with a very political group. In fact, we were... The tour operator was called Political Tours. It's a British organisation that takes people to the world's hotspots. So there were only eight of us, and everyone in the group was there on some mission, had some agenda. The leader was a world expert on North Korea, an East German-born professor at the University of Vienna, and he was extremely knowledgeable. There was a chap there from Google, a young fellow, who was interested in opportunities for artificial intelligence and technology. There was a professor from the University of Bergen in Norway, and there were a few others as well. Everyone was there for some sort of research. We, unlike the journalists who were there for the party congress in May, which you might have heard about in the news, it was the first party congress in 36 years, who were confined to a hotel in Pyongyang and just saw what they were shown. Because we were with a group who and a leader who'd been going twice a year, every year, for the last 6 or 7 or 8 years, we had a lot of inside sights. And we travelled the length and breadth of the country. We didn't just see Pyongyang. Now, of course, they don't like you seeing signs of poverty. They don't like you photographing farmers in bare feet pushing wooden ploughs pulled by oxen, but there was plenty of that. They don't like you photographing the soldiers, who are, by the way, extremely small. Most of these soldiers in their early 20s would have been born in the 90s when there was a famine. There were enough intelligent people in the group and people who'd been before to work out that, you know, things were not always what they seemed. We saw one person being bundled off into a car by what looked like security police. But we also saw some very surprising things that none of us, some of us, had not expected. There are more tall buildings in Pyongyang than I would ever have thought. Acres and acres and acres of tall apartment buildings. And in the city centre, magnificent, cutting-edge designed modern buildings. They obviously have architects who copy the world's best, or they bring the world's best to them. There are sports stadia that you'd, and lots of them, because Kim Jong-un's keen on sport, that you'd expect to see in an Olympic city. There were there was an arch of triumph, modelled on the Arc de Triomphe, same, looks the same, but 11 metres taller. There was a building, which is the mausoleum where the two dead Kims are, called in English the Palace of the Sun, which is modelled on the Palace of Versailles, but bigger. The gardens are not as good, but, you know, the whole thing is bigger. So there's what we saw was quite troubling and perplexing, because there was a lot of money going into public buildings, and no one knows where it comes from. There are no public accounts. There's no transparency. They obviously have coal. There are lots of coal mines. We're told about lots of minerals, rare earth minerals and other things in the mountains of the northeast. and everyone suspects that they trade in arms and nuclear weapons or components. But, you know, it's hard to work out how it all works. And even this professor from Vienna said, you know, it's a mystery. And he went there as a university student 20 years ago. So,
Lindsay.
Does the history guide us as to what you think might happen in the South China Sea?
South China Sea is a very different issue, but what the history does tell us is that China is very proud. Under President Xi, it's aggressive, more so than under previous presidents. And the statement made by the Chinese official 2 weeks ago that China will not stand idly by in the context of the South China Sea made me shudder, because that's what Chou Enlai said in 1950. But other than that, I can only speculate. Personally, talking to Chinese, we went to China afterwards, everyone we spoke to said that the lifeblood of China is trade, and the last thing that they want to do is disrupt trade through the South China Sea. And you've probably heard this or read this. It's possibly the biggest trade route in Asia, because all the traffic, the shipping traffic from Africa, from the Middle East, from Europe, funnels through the Malacca Straits. So they come out of the Indian Ocean, down alongside the Malaysian archipelago, around Singapore, then they turn left and go up through the South China Sea. You know, China needs that. So I'm not sure what's going to happen. And I'm not I don't profess to be an expert.
Yes. Right down the back. Yep.
Thank you for your fascinating comments. Let's take you back to Korea, the Korean War. And you mentioned that North Korea invaded as a vassal state of Russia, but then turned its allegiance to China.
No.
How did that happen? And
No.
Did Russia give up?
No. Russia supplied North Korea with tanks and material, and later its own jets, its MiG-15 jets were used with its own pilots, but some Chinese pilots. I wouldn't say that North Korea was a vassal state, because the Russians had left North Korea in 1948 after the North Korean Republic was established. But they certainly had an interest. Russia, of course, has an adjoining border, not just China. Russia has a border over near Vladivostok. And they were always interested in having a buffer state as well. So North Korea invaded because Kim Il-sung wanted to attempt to unify the peninsula. He did so with Russian arms, because someone had to give him arms. He didn't have enough of his own. China had nothing to do with it and sat back and watched, but was anxious. In fact, Mao had sent a large number of troops up to Manchuria just in case. So they sat there and watched. And they only entered the fray in late October, after the American-led UN forces crossed the 38th parallel and motored towards the northern border.
Down the back. Okay, we're going to move on to this question there. Yeah.
Yes.
Michael, you mentioned the apparent wealth you saw on this recent visit to North Korea.
Yes.
And unable to identify the source of it.
Yes.
Were you at all aware, whilst you were there, of the impact of sanctions on North Korea?
Yes, there was considerable talk about it. Of course, we had no official statement made to us. What we did was talk amongst ourselves, and there were some knowledgeable people. But we were told that it is hurting. It's hurting. We're also told that not everyone agrees in the world, and that Nelson Mandela once said, in opposition to sanctions, better to trade with your enemy and he will become your friend. So the short answer is it's impossible to say. We didn't conduct a survey to see whether there was a shortage of this, that or the other. The sanctions are mostly directed at the things that are not designed to hurt the ordinary people. They're not trying to starve the people of North Korea. They're trying to prevent the elite and the country having more weapons than they should have.
So as a final question, we start off with Governor Phillip and we end up with the Kim communist dictatorship in North Korea. And all this has come about in the last few years. So is it just when you're sitting on the bench, it's all a bit boring and you want to write history? I mean, how did you suddenly become a historian, sort of coincided with your elevation, your honour, if you understand what I mean?
It started in my last year or two as a barrister when I was getting bored of being a barrister. And I wrote my first book, which was called Trees of History and Romance, which was a very different sort of book. And that was successful and I enjoyed the process. And in my first 5 years as a judge, perhaps four years, I just made the time. Occasionally you get settlements, occasionally time opens up and you just... And I work weekends. So if any of you have a hobby, you know that it doesn't tie you to work all weekend on your hobby. I come in invigorated on Monday morning, having spent all of Saturday and all of Sunday in my study. I come down for morning tea and lunch. I talk to my wife in the afternoon. And I usually stop about 6:45 at night.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it's certainly been a productive few years. So thanks for coming along tonight and talking about a bit about your past book and a bit about your coming book. I should say congratulations on the success of your Governor Phillip biography. It's been very successful and very well reviewed, and best wishes for your new project, wherever that may take you. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
Thank you. And as I said, there are copies. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.